Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Health Tech Pigeon podcast. I'm James, and with me today I have Hugh from the Somex team. Hugh, welcome. How are you doing, mate?
Thanks, James. I'm doing all right. It's a busy week, but all exciting. Looking forward to talking about some really cool stories this week. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, we're talking about funding, we're talking about VR, we're going to talk about Apple getting sued and what that means for startups and entrepreneurship. And we're going to be talking about breastfeeding and booby biome. Notwithstanding the obvious irony that two men are talking about that, but I think it's a good thing that two men are willing to talk about that. So let's do it. On to our first story. All right, our first story this week, Fierce Healthcare has reported on Q1 numbers, basically. So they've looked at the funding across health tech and they've said, firstly, there's more deal volume, so more startups are getting funded. Lower check sizes, though, so investors are being a little bit more cautious with how much they're putting in to digital health companies. And AI investment is leading the pack. Well, surprise, surprise. So what Fierce Healthcare have done, they've looked at Rock Health's report and they've come up with all of these conclusions. Yeah, Hugh, you've had a read of this. What do you reckon?
Yeah, so I think it's really obviously good news that there's a lot more deals happening, that people are actually getting involved and putting, you know, their money where their mouth is, and things are getting funded. I think the decline in deal size is a little bit of a worry, but I think it probably reflects a bit more caution, a little bit more onus on startups to prove what, you know, profitability, what long-term revenue generation looks like for them. And I think it's obviously a case of external factors and some pretty massive stories over the last year or so in terms of what's going on in digital health. Really some good points made in this article, looking at particularly some six big D-lists from major stock exchanges over the last year as well. We have seen a lot of public health tech, digital health companies delisted, either going private or going out of business entirely, which is obviously putting people, I mean, if you were an investor, you'd be looking at it and saying, okay, well, is going public, is that dream of a big exit, you know, from digital health really quite what it once was? You know, are we going to see the investments that we put into a company now turn into something like that? I think, you know, in the last few months, we've seen some quite interesting articles saying the big exit isn't the big exit. You know, the going public isn't the only way, and you know, mergers, acquisitions are all different options out there. And I think with that knowledge and that understanding and seeing some great examples of great health tech companies coming out over the last year at some really interesting raises from across the board, it's probably giving everyone a decent amount of confidence. It is going to be harder. It is clearly much more of a struggle. We've seen it from a lot of the companies we work with, just how difficult raising is right now. You have to prove so much more than you did a year, 18 months ago. You have to demonstrate revenue. You have to demonstrate, you know, just what that potential is. And it's not just, wow, that's a great idea, that could change the world. You have to demonstrate that you are about to, you're on the precipice before that money comes in. So I think, yeah, it's an interesting time. I'm also quite interested in this. Obviously, AI-based startups are going to be rising in the number of the deals that are going on. Yeah. The article rightly points out it's up at 44% of startups, digital health startups that are getting raises in are AI-based, up from 33% in last year's one. I'm not honestly shocked, given the world we live in right now. I'd love to see a breakdown of this, and I'm sure someone has done it, of what this splits by different therapy areas, different types of technology. Like, we're using AI, how does it break down? Because the companies listed on the 150 million or more that AI health tech startups have raised, you know, they're from across the board. The Ambience, Fabric, Zephyr, Abridge, Codemetrics, Limbic. There's a lot of different things in there doing a lot of different applications of AI, a lot of different types of AI. So I'd love to see the breakdown and see what's actually like, okay, AI is making people invest. What are the places where people are going, no, that makes sense? Yeah, there's a lot in here. It's really interesting. But, you know, I won't go too deep. Do go and read the article for yourself. I'd love to get your thoughts.
And the report, indeed. Yeah, Rock Health are really good at this. Obviously, those Rock Health reports are absolutely incredible. And yeah, this article does make some good points. You're right about the stock delistings, right? And you know, for us in the startup world, you might not look at those kind of public markets and think that it has anything to do with, you know, angel investors putting their money in. In reality, it does, just in first principles, because I think what we're seeing now is digital health companies should have been IPOing, huge acquisitions. All these things should have, it feels like these things should have been happening. And it feels like people are waking up to the fact of, hold on a minute, they're not. And not only that, the ones that did SPAC or IPO and list in some way, shape or form haven't done that well. And we've had these things go down in flames and people have lost a lot of money, which affects confidence. It affects confidence to invest in things in the public markets, and therefore people don't invest in the public markets. What that means is the people that have invested along the way to help that company go public, the Series A, the seed, the Series A, the Series B, the Series C, they're the ones that then lose out. So of course, they are then not going to make those investments, or as we've seen here, they're going to ask more questions, they're going to be more cautious, they're going to do maybe more deals, but maybe less size because they're spreading their risk and you know, making that go a bit further. So it is important that we look at public markets. It is important that when digital health companies do list on a stock market that they do well. That's good for the sector. That's good for the space. So that was the first thing that I saw. The other thing is that the article mentions here that the trend of creative deal structuring continued in the first quarter as digital health startups navigate a tighter funding market. The example that they use here is unlabeled rounds. I think this is interesting because, again, in the startup world, we're so used to this kind of, you do a pre-seed, well, you do a friends and family, like a pre-seed to kind of work on the idea. You then have an MVP, you do a seed round, you get some early traction, you do a Series A, you get $1 million revenue, you do a Series B, or indeed all those milestones have sort of shifted one backwards, I think, in the time that I've even been in digital health. Now you need $1 million to do a seed round, seemingly, because the pre-seed is what gets you then. But anyway, the point is, I think as capital has been more and more difficult to get hold of, things like bridge rounds are starting to become more and more common, you know, or an A plus or a seed plus, or this is the second half of our Series A. It seems like we're tied to this structure because it sort of labels a startup as in a certain category, and you want to be perceived as a Series A or a Series B and all the rest of it. All that truly matters is that if you raise the capital, you deploy it, and the price per share increases. As long as you're adding value onto the company, you're doing the thing. That is ultimately the most important thing for the shareholders. Maybe I'm criticizing the sector that we're in media for seemingly want to put people in pigeonholes and label them and making it perhaps a little bit more difficult for startups to exist and go up the rounds and all these different things. So that was the second thing that I noted in this. And the third thing, the final thing that I will mention here, is that it says an analysis from the Peterson Health Technology Institute, sounds like a great institute, ruffled some feathers by concluding that digital management tools are not worth the cost. For example, diabetes monitoring apps do not deliver meaningful clinical benefits and result in increased healthcare spending, the analysis found. So it is important that where we are deploying these things, they are deployed with the right health economics done previously, which is what I spoke to Hugh Harvey about on the Health Tech Podcast episode that went out this week. People are getting to health economics a little bit too late. They are doing their regulatory, they are raising their funding and building their product, spending all of that, as I say, on product development, regulatory, getting to market, and then realizing, hold on a minute, the economics doesn't stack up. If you are a first principles thinker, or indeed from any other sector rather than entrepreneurship or venture-backed entrepreneurship, that might sound like a strange order to do things, which indeed it is a little bit of a strange order to do things. We all have to, in entrepreneurship and the startup world, go on a little bit of wing and a prayer or finger in the wind or assumptions, let's just say they should be. They should be, those assumptions should be tested as much as you can with the capital and time that you have available. And you have to at some point take a bit of a leap. But indeed, if we're allowing institutes to conclude that certain digital tools are not worth the cost, then we're putting somewhat of the whole sector at risk here, by again decreasing investor confidence and all the rest of it. So that's a bit of a plug for listening to that podcast that I did with Hugh, but also a little bit of a plug to consider early economic models before you are getting to market, to at least know that there's some sort of a business model there rather than just sort of building it in the hope that they will come. So those are three things that I noticed.
So, I mean, I'm just going to jump on a couple of those points because they're all really interesting. I think there's a few things to break down. Yeah, that Peterson Health Institute report, we actually featured it in Pigeon a couple of weeks ago. It's a really interesting story. We described that institute as basically like NICE, but if the board was full of venture capitalists, it is basically doing a NICE type job in terms of looking at the, you know, evaluating health technologies for use in the US health system. It's quite interesting. It will have its own agenda. It
has its limitations.
Yeah, exactly. This article's a little bit misleading on this one because that report only covered the diabetes ones. It's like your typical NICE health technology assessment report or, you know, early indicator thing. And it just said it did find, and it was scathing. It was really scathing. It was sort of, some of them were like, oh yeah, we had a look at them all and, you know, like one or two of them showed a clinical benefit, but it wasn't statistically significant. And everyone was spending more on these tools and it was doing absolutely nothing compared to just self-management with some clinical support. It's a mad report and really valuable that they're out there doing these things. I don't know if it applies to all digital health solutions. That said, you know, a couple of, I think it might be a month ago now, we did have that really nice report where all the digital health execs in US hospitals said they were spending more on digital health. They hadn't seen a return on investment, but they were going to keep spending more on digital health. I'm assuming that's a long-term play. Like that is not me talking down the sector. I think people are just looking more long-term than we bought a tool. We expected it to make a difference in a year. We can't expect that. That digital health will always be a long-term play overall. And I think that's really important and really critical that we look at it in that regard. You're never going to see that individual change you are sometimes. There are some really good examples, but you're rarely going to see that individual change make such a difference in like 3 to 6 months basis. Like if you've adopted a tool and you're like, oh wow, why are we not seeing 100% changes? Or, you know, why is it not just solving our problem immediately? There are things to look at before you go, this didn't work. And there are pathways to consider. There are changes you can make. There are definitely things. The onus shouldn't be on the clinician to do that, but there is definitely work that institutions can do when they adopt new technologies to look at, okay, well, it didn't save us money this time. Is there a way we can adopt it or implement it where it did? Particularly if it gets to the point where it's being procured anyway. Surely there is an indication that it could save money. And in order to scale it and make it work, that's your challenge. Scale and adopt is always the hardest part with a lot of these digital health solutions. So, yeah, before we give the Peterson Health Institute the remit to destroy digital health, I mean, it'll destroy itself if people think that's what it's saying, that just digital health is useless. Well, fine, whatever, okay. And then the other point on that, like, unlabeled rounds piece, I think it's really interesting, and I think you've got a really big point about, like, the media wanting to fit raises and funding rounds into little boxes. Like, oh, you know, if I send a press release that says, oh, we raised a couple of mil, outside around, yeah, just to top ourselves up, very few people are going to care. If I say we did a Series A plus, you know, journalists probably cares just that little bit more. I'm not saying it's going to get you coverage, but they probably understand it a bit more and they don't have to work hard to understand it. That said, these unlabeled rounds are becoming a lot more common, and and I think it's a symptom of something else that's changing, which is these rounds aren't, like, funding isn't becoming, isn't, you can't put it in a box as much anymore. You can't say we did the Series A, then we did all of these milestones, then we moved on to the Series B, then we did all of these milestones. I've spoken to a few companies over the last sort of 6 months to a year where, you know, they say we've completed our Series A, we're raising already. Like, we haven't announced the Series A raise, but we're moving into it. I spoke to a chief of staff last year. They'd finished their funding round. They were getting ready to announce it, but they were already a couple of months into talks for their next round, and they weren't going to call it anything because it just didn't make sense to. They just needed to keep on raising, keep going. What I'm interested to know is how the impact of these continuous raising rounds, these like completely unlabeled rounds where we're not sure what milestones are, is on internal companies. What do you have to do to satisfy investor demands on that level of continuous funding? You know, if you're, okay, well, we satisfied the Series A, you know, our investor told us they wouldn't invest unless we had this on the board. We had these three contracts. We had a revenue of this much, that we cut our burn rate by this much, that we cut our staff by this much. Okay, we've done that. We've moved into the next one. Okay, well, they said for the next round, we need to cut our burn rate. Like, there are people who are going to be working in these companies who are impacted by this continuous raising. Companies need to do it. That is definitely a model that, you know, we're moving more towards. But the impact on staff, I think, is going to make that startup life even harder. That kind of the uncertainty, the instability for people within those startups is just going to become a bit less certain than it already is.
So I
think there's definitely something for funders, but also for founders to kind of work on that point of how do you, when you're constantly raising, how do you give that extra little bit of stability to your team?
It's a really good point. That's going to affect your talent management, talent acquisition, talent retention. Like, yeah, because uncertainty is not good for anybody. And it's a really complicated comms activity, isn't it? As you say, for internal comms there. But I guess from the investor side, it'd be like, it actually just encourages a constant dialogue, doesn't it? Because it's funny, like as you were talking then, thinking about, you know, we have metrics for seed level and we hit those, we're going to do a Series A. Then we've got more metrics. And if we hit those metrics, we're going to do a Series B. It does ignore the fact that the market can change, the expectations can change, the amount of money available can change, the amount of customers available can change, the amount of talent available can change. So many things can change. And we've been recently just in a period of every expectation that was placed on a fund round surely just went in the bin, and new expectations were put on the table, and then they went in the bin, and then new ones came up again, and then they went in the bin and new ones came up again. So it really is nobody's fault there. You'd expect it, if, for the later ones anyway, you'd expect some of these investors to be on the board, so they are actually seeing and having a constant dialogue with those founders to kind of iterate that in real time, I guess. But yeah, it's been a real struggle. You're right, though. I think that must impact workforce. It must impact how people feel in those types of companies. And I mean, there's people that we can probably get on the podcast and ask about this sort of thing, because there's been a lot of people that you and I know that have had to make very difficult decisions. And been on both sides of that as well. So it's definitely tough. The other thing I just wanted to pull up as well, like the bit you mentioned before about essentially the... Some people paying and then not seeing the results, and then institutes writing about it and fostering this kind of like discontent of like, oh, digital health doesn't work. It's funny because in the massive conversation I had with you about health economics, it's funny because it's so complex that once you introduce a new thing into a health system, it changes so many other things that actually capturing the value of it is another science and another bit of art to actually figure out, well, what was actually the benefit? Because you fundamentally change a clinical pathway sometimes. Actually, what happens is the person that pays sees absolutely no benefit. They might even see things getting worse. But 12 different people that are not that person may well have seen it. Now, the idea of doing a health economics analysis prior is that you put all this on the table and you're like, right, this person's going to pay, but these departments are going to save. Then it gets funded at a higher level that can appreciate things crossing budget boundaries. And I think that's the thing with healthcare, is that where budget boundaries are constrained within a certain area, it can actually be quite difficult to introduce something that is paid for and creates the same saving within that smaller kind of economy or ecosystem, or frankly, department or clinic, or you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. And actually what happens is, with some of these economic analyses you were saying, is that what you say is, below 5,000 patients, this doesn't work. Above 5,000 patients, it's put into the radiology department, but the respiratory department is the one that's going to save massively for all of these types of reasons, because we're, you know, there's a reduced complication rate, there's reduced readmission rate, there's reduced this, there's reduced that. So A&E is going to see a saving, and these are going to see a saving, and this is going to see a saving, but the radiology department is going to feel completely out of pocket. So actually, we're not going to ask them to pay. We're actually going to ask the trust to pay. We're going to ask this to pay. That's like, do you know what I mean? It's like, and that's what's interesting, that I think, you know, you can look very two-dimensionally at digital health and go, well, I want to introduce this thing and they're going to save, they're going to get in-year ROI savings, all the rest of it, and it's going to be a wonderful business model. In reality, the problems are so complex that actually that becomes your moat. If you are a company, if you are an entrepreneur or a co-founding team that can actually get into the weeds and the mess of this and go, actually, here's what I think practically will work, this product, this device, this app, this system, this blah, 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 whatever, this software, this is what I think is going to make the change. But then the challenge is like figuring out how that does actually change everything. That can be your moat. That can be what prevents any competition, because that's so messy and difficult that actually that will then prevent institutes saying, oh, it just doesn't work and blah, blah, blah. Whereas in reality, you know, you said it yourself, we don't think this is working. We can't see any ROI, but we're going to keep doing it because actually it probably feels right. People are a bit happier, like people, but they're not capturing those in metrics necessarily that are that tangible. And we know this leads somewhere good. We know this is getting better, but we just can't measure it. And there's no metric that I can point to, but I feel it's better. But yeah, I guess that might explain some of that. But anyway, there you have it. That was Q1. More deal volume, lower check size, lots of AI. That's the summary. And institutes that are going to say that digital health is terrible, just pipe down. Just take zoom out, zoom out, and pipe down.
Yeah, take that, Peterson Health Institute.
Next story today, we actually talk about this quite a lot, but VR, easing pain in cancer trials. Hugh, this is something that you have read. Want to say a little bit about?
Yeah, so it's the latest story about how virtual reality can be used for like a therapeutic effect. And in this case, it's a pain relief effect. It's for, basically for cancer patients, 128 individuals taking part in a trial from Georgetown University School of Medicine and MedStar Health in the United States were randomly placed into two conditions, watching 10 minutes of guided imagery on an iPad tablet or an immersive VR experience when essentially being used to ease their pain following cancer treatment. And the results, super positive. Both cohorts felt reduced pain, but the change was more pronounced for the VR group. Lead researcher said results from this trial suggest that immersive VR may be a useful non-medication strategy to improve the cancer pain experience. Really interesting data was that, you know, they were still feeling the benefits of this immersive VR experience a day later. Like, you know, receiving a treatment for pain relief and you're still feeling the effects a day later, there are very few treatments I can think of where that effect is going to carry on. And I think if you've been within something that's technological rather than pharmaceutical, that's, you know, even more impressive. That's a really, that's an incredible outcome. And you know, this follows on from a story that we had on Pigeon a few weeks back, just looking at the use of VR in VR as pain relief during sort of minor operations, so sort of stent replacements, things like that. Yeah, that was used at Gillingham Hospital. A really great story. It's on the BBC. Go look at it or look at one of the more recent episodes, editions of Pigeon, to kind of see the impact there. And I think what this basically means is that we are getting some really interesting alternatives to just purely pharmaceutical applications for pain relief in areas where you wouldn't necessarily expect it. You know, these are the kind of interesting uses of technology that I think no one necessarily expected VR to be. Like, you know, we've seen it deployed for training. We've seen it deployed for skills and giving simulation. But I think really its application in healthcare specifically and the patient benefit is clearly becoming a really significant thing. Obviously, it's not new. Like, these trials have been going on, and James, I know you spoke to Keith, so like, it'd be really interesting to sort of get a sense of that. I think it's very interesting because, I mean, I've you know, dug a bit deep into the kind of historical use, and I thought, okay, well, I've recently had some treatment, and it turns out the procedure I had, local anesthetic, you're awake through the whole thing, gas and air, and they, a couple of years ago, 2021, they trialed VR in that, and it did work. I'm slightly annoyed because I didn't get offered any VR. Mm. No one showed me a immersive experience of an Icelandic waterfall when I was having that procedure. And then I did sort of think, when we get to that kind of health economic piece, you know, a bit of local anesthetic and some gas and air or nitrox or whatever the pain relief there does feel a bit cheaper than a VR headset. I don't know whether that'd be the case long term, but yeah, I'm keen to kind of get your thoughts on this, James, and where you see VR's potential here.
Yeah, it's interesting, man, because like I wonder when this is going to click. And or whether it will. I think there are a few technologies that sort of come into healthcare and they get dropped in, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, now we're doing it. Like a new medical device of any sort, really, that would be used in surgery or this, that, the other. Like that just, it becomes like, oh, okay, this works. This is a new standard. This is what we're doing now. Everyone adopts it over time, over a couple of years, whatever. And then like, oh, cool, this is the new thing. VR, and again, that's quite reductive and not necessarily true for everything, but like VR is like the complete opposite of that. It's sort of like spluttered along, and it's like, you mentioned I talked to Keith. Yeah, I spoke to Keith Grimes last week for a podcast that will come out in a couple of weeks. But yeah, he was talking about, he just completely anecdotally in his own practice, it was one of the first things he did in sort of health tech, in inverted commas. He kind of intuitively knew that if he stuck a VR headset on someone, it would distract them. And it was for wound packing, which is, you know, pretty painful procedure. Mm. And he said it was in this, you know, single case, anecdotally, it was completely transformative for how effective it was for pain relief. And so he was then hooked, and it was like, right, this is now a thing. And you kind of think that like, what happened to like seeing it anecdotally, doing a study, then it being adopted and blah, blah, blah. But you're right. The health economics comes along. VR headsets are expensive, but then I think VR has struggled to get away from the feeling of a gimmick quite often. Mm. And it's definitely getting there now. And I think that's what's had to happen, is that it has spluttered along and people have done these studies. And it's sort of like you're introducing a toy into the clinical space. This isn't really fitting with like our hardcore academic nature, where we like to debate the 2 percentage points on this therapy versus that therapy, and this molar mass versus this molar mass, and you know, this decimal point of treatment of a drug versus this. So it's rubbed up against, I think, the healthcare space quite a lot. But we've seen, you know, I both work with HoloCare. Like, we've seen HoloCare now like being deployed into like clinical spaces. They're sticking VR headsets on an MDT and helping them do surgical planning, because you can rotate the organ in 3D. You can visualize the tumor, you can visualize the vessels. The surgeons can visualize their approach in real time. And yes, in some ways that's fun. What's wrong with that? It's also really useful to see a CT scan in 3D and be able to rotate it and manipulate it if you want a fast view. And I think this is the thing, like when you move to somewhere new, it always upsets an old guard. It always upsets like the true way of doing things. Keith mentioned that when the thermometer first got introduced, there was outrage that the thermometer was doing away with the art of interpreting temperature human to human. The human act of putting a hand on a patient and interpreting temperature is now being reduced to this single number that we're going to make decisions on, and that's going to be terrible. And the reality is that what happens is medicine changes around this new way of doing things, because yes, I can actually appreciate in some way you are somewhat reducing the art of medicine there, because you're taking a human interpretation, turning it into a metric. And then all of a sudden you can see, can't you, of like, oh, are we, is that all we're going to do now? You extrapolate that and you're like, oh, so the human is just going to be sat behind loads of numbers. We're going to make all the decision on numbers and we're not going to connect with patients. That's a terrible thing. And it's like, well, actually, yes, to some extent, because it allows scalability. If we can reduce everything to numbers, the truth is you can't reduce everything to numbers. It just means that what you can reduce to numbers, you do. That makes things measurable. It makes trends observable, and it makes new treatments possible, and it makes new research possible on what we are doing. It allows for experimentation. It allows, and all of a sudden you see medicine evolving. And I think that's the interesting thing here, because I wonder what medicine would look like if you allowed VR to proliferate and then you redesign medicine. We're seeing this now with large language models. We're seeing a lot of, you're going to erode the fabric of healthcare if you put AI models in between the clinician and the patient, right? You can't have an AI model take a history. You can't have an AI model deliver a talking therapy. I've said it myself, it can't deliver empathy, and therefore, if we become okay with an AI delivering talking therapy, like all of a sudden we've eroded the fabric of what healthcare is, a human to human care. That sounds mightily like those people talking about thermometers. And, you know, I got to check myself there and be like, well, is this actually what I believe? Because actually I do believe in innovation moving forwards. And whilst I do appreciate that, of course, we want to put a human speaking to another human wherever it is possible, you can't ignore the fact we have a scalability issue in healthcare. And so I wonder, like, as I say, if VR is allowed to proliferate and we design healthcare around it, what does it look like? It's just never been given that chance, I don't think, because people are behind these arguments of it's an expensive device, it's a gimmick, it doesn't really do this, it doesn't really do that. But over the last 10 years, more these studies keep coming out, these stories keep coming out, like, as distraction therapy and reducing pain, it works. In education and training, it works. In surgical planning, it works. And people want it. And it's like what we talked about before. There's some also imperceptible, perhaps intangible, not so measurable benefits to doing this that I imagine if an entire MDT, an entire multidisciplinary team is watching a lung or a liver or whatever it is spinning in 3D, and people are talking about the surgery that they're about to do, what does that do for the cohesion of that team? What does that do for the teamwork in that team? Like, you know, if you've watched like The Last Dance or any of that kind of like NBA style, like far out teaching of like next gen stuff, like they all sit and meditate together, they do breathing exercises together because they all become more in sync and all these things. Like, we can't know all the benefits of something. We can do our best to understand it, but at the end of the day, workforce satisfaction has to come into there at some point.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you can measure efficiency savings down the line, but in the, like, my mind also just goes to like, just be a bit more fun, be a bit more fun to do a few bits and bobs in VR, like, let alone the fact it allows me to, like, it depends how good your like non-verbal reasoning is for how much you can visualize an organ in 3D from 2D. Like, just, it's now in 3D, boom. We've now removed that. That's no longer a thing. Like, you don't have to think about that. Like, oh, where does that vessel? Like, it's interesting, isn't it? And I just, yeah, part of me is like, I don't think VR's been given a good enough chance. So that's, I guess, where I sit.
It's on healthcare's own Overton window, isn't it? It's the what is acceptable today will change us tomorrow. And we just need to get past that point. I think you had an interesting piece on the, like, you there, which was on the, like, break it down by numbers, but also break it down on the, like, the get past that Overton window. What is that resistance? What is that, like, thing that isn't based on the numbers as well? And if you can combine the two and you can come up with a strong enough argument across the board based on numbers and that, yeah, okay, it's not a gimmick, get over yourself. I mean, I you can pretty, like, on the first point, just going on the numbers, you know, the start of this article, I think really interesting. During the trial on cancer patients, those in the iPad group, so remember that 10-minute iPad-based approach reported an average drop of 0.7 points on the pain scale. Not bad. Whereas those in the VR group had an average drop of 1.4. Even 24 hours after the interventions, patients in the VR group reported sustained improvement in their pain severity at 1.7 points below the baseline before any interventions, whereas those in the iPad group reported scores 0.3% lower. So immersive distraction is even better than normal distraction, is the kind of theory here. I think numbers like that, really bringing together like this broad, across-the-spectrum proof of this is what you can do. And then I think on the flip side, it's persuading people that when you put on your headset, you're not going to see a terrible animated version of Mark Zuckerberg with no legs. Like, that's what I think people... I think we're going to talk about Apple in our next story because in a slightly negative light probably, but I think there's probably a positive thing coming out from something like the Vision Pro and its release recently. Yeah. Utterly... unaffordable consumer device at $3,500. Utterly, yeah. You know, whatever you're talking about that way, if it's unaffordable to the consumer at $3,500, it's definitely going to be unaffordable to healthcare at that as well. But what it's going to do is it's going to push forward the quality. It's going to push forward the affordability. And like 5 years from now, we're going to be talking about, you know, obviously Meta are already doing their version a lot cheaper. But I think we're going to see VR is just going to become better and higher quality, and there's going to be more competition in that space to the point that they'll be putting out devices that are lighter, easier, don't have the quite entertaining pain problems that Apple's version seems to be creating, but also pushing forward the market, and it'll be a lot more affordable for healthcare to adopt something, and we'll have these numbers, we'll have this far more acceptability of VR globally, even not within the healthcare market. It'll be just a more common thing. I don't think we're going to see people walking down the street with it on. They just look stupid. But in healthcare, I think we're going to see those applications, the numbers, the affordability, the ease of use, and frankly, just it being a more sensible procurement choice for healthcare organizations and hopefully for the clinical bodies as well.
Yeah, I just think if the operating system and the software gets good enough, then we get to the point of like, why wouldn't you do that in 3D? Why would you look at imaging in 2D when you can look at imaging in 3D? That's the point it'd be interesting to get to. Next story today, Priya Abani, who is CEO of AliveCor, has penned an article in Yahoo Finance saying this: I lead one of the startups accusing Apple of patent infringement. Here is why Congress should side with us. Hugh, I'm going to let you explain this one because I know that you've read it and have a view.
Yeah, so some may say that this story started in late 2023 when Apple launched its Apple Watch Ultra 2 and Apple Watch 9, a boring consumer story, some might say. Lots of people flooded towards it. But one of the kind of key new features, really exciting new features that they were plugging for, you know, all of the big tech companies want to get involved in this wearable space, want to be really demonstrating the kind of real world healthcare benefits. It's gone beyond the consumer device. That watch on your wrist isn't just something that you bought because you want the latest Apple gadget. It's something that has real world healthcare applications. It can be valuable for tracking your metrics. It could be valuable in the future for your healthcare. It could save your life. And there's a lot of great Apple comms that they put out, great Apple PR pieces. And I think that, you know, this isn't me criticizing them. I think it's really good work that they do where they get the people who their Apple Watch did save their life. They had a fall. It called an ambulance. There's really great stories out there. These devices can save lives. But one of the big features that Apple launched in the latest round was this ECG functionality. So your Apple Watch can monitor your heart rate and detect atrial fibrillation. Real value of having an ECG on your wrist. The only problem was AliveCor and several other companies had similar applications. They had similar technologies and similar devices. And frankly, from their point of view, their patents, which they had for their technologies and had launched in front of proper bodies, they'd done all the defensibility things that they needed to do. as far as they're concerned, the technology in Apple's Apple Watch was an infringement on their IP. So they sued Apple. They went and they launched this case in front of the courts, who sided with them. They said Apple could not sell Apple Watches with that ECG functionality, or at least they said they couldn't sell them in their current form. So Apple has since turned off that technology within the Apple Watch. It's still in there. All of the right technology is in the Apple Watch to do it, but you cannot actually use it. They've not gone back to the factory settings. They've not taken out the technology. It's in there. You just can't use it. They're not allowed to sell it with that technology switched on. In response, Apple have gone on the offensive themselves. They've gone and they've tried to invalidate some of the patents at the US Patent Office for AliveCor and some of these other companies. From this article, from Priya Abani, who's the CEO at AliveCor, is essentially telling their side of the story. They are stuck in these patent, this major patent battle with Apple about whose technology it is. They're confident they're going to win. They're confident they're going to have that invalidation turned over on appeal. And we don't want to take sides. But I think this is a really interesting story of what happens when digital health companies have these technologies and then big tech puts out something very similar.
Yeah, I'll take a side. I'll happily take a side here. I'll take the side of AliveCor any day of the week here, because for me, this is like massive, enormous, multinational, biggest tech company in the world wants to just nick a technology and stick it in a smartphone and a smartwatch. It's pretty barn door, in my view, because here's the bit in the article, right? Apple's attempting to argue, and I appreciate this, by the way, Apple's attempting to argue that a ban on basically the technology being in the Apple Watch that can detect various dodgy heart rhythms, etc., would deprive people of a device that's crucial to their health. That's a fine argument, but that basically just says that you can sort of reverse Robin Hood anything if you're a massive technology corporation and can hand it to more people and make more money and more impact. That basically just makes stealing okay if you're just bigger than the next guy. So you talk about capitalism just getting unregulated and therefore running out of control and creating enormous monopolies. That is literally that. That is that argument. And this is the exact sort of government imposed policy and legal precedent that has to be put in place so that capitalism is not allowed to run ragged and just create a completely one-sided and unfair system where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That is literally what we're talking about here. And I don't think that's grandiose to say in relation to this, because I do think this is of a significant level of issue that argument becomes reasonable, because if you allow this to happen, that's the precedent for what next. The next big tech company spots the next startup, steals the technology, puts it in their car or in their tablet or in their laptop, and just goes, yeah, we can sell it to more people and it's actually really good, so we're gonna make more impact, so cool, yeah, that's completely fine. Absolutely outrageous. Because the article then goes on to say that to that argument, in fact, the opposite is true. Allowing Apple to get away with continued infringement will kill innovation and endanger people's health. Yes, because the other side of capitalism is that one of the reasons that capitalism moves us forward is because it allows entrepreneurs to take massive risk for the benefit of massive reward. And that is part of what capitalism is based on, the idea that you can incentivize people to then create new things, allow ideas to become businesses and then those businesses to make impact. If you then basically say that you as a small-time entrepreneur can have this amazing idea, but it might just get nicked by a big tech company because it can make impact much quicker than you, rather than that big tech company can offer to acquire it, which, by the way, is kind of the easy solution here. Yeah, that big company can go make impact, and they can go, but they can also bloody pay for it. Come on, like, anyway, it's my view.
And it's where if we jump back to the first story we were discussing, like, it's that big point, you know, these companies own that massive reward can be anything. And in this case, a very simple licensing of the technology. Well, I take that back. Very simple. This is the wrong word, and patent lawyers are listening are shouting this right now. But a licensing of the technology, an acquisition of the company, these are all that reward, that big reward, whether that's, you know, or the company, if it really believes it can do it, you know, gets to that point where it can go public and becomes a real competitor. But where we get to the point where companies can just feel like they can take the technology or replicate the technology very close to that patent, that's when we struggle. That's when that's when all of those incentives are off the table. But acquisition, licensing, or competition have to be the options. And that's the whole point in patent defensibility. You've got to be able to protect your innovation.
Absolutely. And the actionable advice here for startups listening, I can remember the first Alive Core, by the way. I can remember that first device. I can remember it. I can remember Alive Core going through, you know, the smartphone where you held it and all the technologies that it inspired. There was lots of people doing the same thing. Like, it was, I can remember those early days of this technology. And I don't know, man, like the thought of like all of those entrepreneurs putting all of that energy in, you have to defend your technology. Any one of those early ones actually could have, AliveCore's always like, I would say head and shoulders. I think that's fair to say of the people that are trying to do that kind of ECG in a smartphone case technology type stuff. They were always probably going to be the ones that made it, but legitimately so, it could have been anyone. And actually, protect your technology. Make sure that your IP is protected. It's such an important point, because it is what then gives you, it gives you something to sell, it gives you that IP to sell, but also it protects you when this type of thing happens. Because I can imagine there are plenty of cases where this has happened, where IP hasn't been fully protected and the wrong side wins. So,
And the flip side of that, as a story that I was told very recently, is if you're an early stage innovator, and I'm talking really early stage, planning out your idea, check what other ideas have been patented and don't spend 2 years developing something that someone already has a patent on.
Oof. Yes, indeed. Indeed. So there you have it. David versus Goliath. I think on this one, I'm on the side of David. But we'll move on. So our final story today, well, it's not quite a story, it's sort of a collection of stories. There's a company, a health tech company called Booby Biome, and there are lots of things being written about them. Well, the article that we've got in the newsletter this week is from Femtech Insider, how UK-based Booby Biome is advancing infant feeding, harnessing the power of breast milk microbiome. I have done some reading on Booby Biome this morning, and what an incredible company. What a fascinating company. What they have done. They have done loads of research into essentially what makes babies healthy and the infant microbiome. And they have come out with two products on the back of this research. And what they found is that a healthy breast milk microbiome contains many different bacterial species, particularly anaerobic bacteria. Now that becomes very important, because these anaerobic bacteria have probiotic functions that help to produce a healthy infant gut. In contrast to that, unhealthy breast milk microbiomes show less diversity and smaller portions of probiotic bacteria, which may stem from antibiotic usage. So learning that antibiotics have an effect. But interestingly, this anaerobic bacteria, so what they've done is they've created a product which can be attached to an infant's feeding bottle that creates an anaerobic environment. It preserves the beneficial bacteria and vitamins, therefore prevents the growth of some of those harmful bacteria. There's a nice extra benefit, extends the shelf life of the milk, keeping the milk more fresh. And yeah, if you're pumping or storing, it's what they say, an absolute game changer to guarantee that your baby receives nothing but the highest quality breast milk. They've also developed a probiotic, which contains kind of, yeah, live bacteria, basically, that they've isolated from breast milk. And it also has prebiotic fibers and all sorts of stuff to promote the correct bacterial growth. But yeah, you put that into formula milk or breast milk so that parents can provide their babies with a proper or better breast milk microbiome. Incredible science, because one of the founders has won a chemistry prize because of this. They've been featured in loads and loads of stuff, and rightly so. It's sort of like, it's one of those things that you know it's a good idea when you do this, when you go like, why has no one ever thought of this before? Incredible idea. The founders have done PhDs. They are proper three proper female scientists. And congratulations to them, like rightly so. What a company.
So I think this is really exciting. There's obviously a lot of research going on across the board about how the microbiome can influence, you know, health outcomes. There's a lot of work on the gut microbiome, its impact on the brain, the brain's microbiome. And I think research into how microorganisms and bacteria really influence health outcomes is clearly incredibly valuable, and is clearly a huge, I think you know, there's a lot of potential for even more development here. I think what Booby Biome here have done is jump back to that first principles piece. We've really given people the best start in life. There's the huge amount of research on the importance of, you know, those early years, those really early years post-birth, in terms of shaping people's health outcomes further down the line, further, you know, way into their lifespan. So I think this is really exciting. And just looking at the importance of that relationship between mother and baby, and particularly from that really scientific impact, I think I'm really interested to see what this could look like in the future. I think we're gonna try and get them on the podcast and talk to them about this in a bit more. I think there's definitely impact on health inequalities to be looked at. Could this be rolled out to improve outcomes for babies in different countries, in different demographics? Are there health outcomes and maternity outcomes that we can spot and address with essentially microbiology, your bacteria? You know, what can we do to give babies that start where they might not have had it in the first place? And I think really excited to follow their journey. They're a great company.
Yeah, I'm just reading an interview that the co-founders have done a couple of years ago now, actually. But yeah, a dysbiotic microbiome tends to be less diverse and rich in aerobic, oxygen-tolerant species that could be pathogenic. The breast milk bacteria that we typically look at to help nourish the gut epithelial cells and prevent gut diseases, such as necrotizing enterocolitis and preterm infants. God, like, that's so true. When I did my neonates job, like, the big thing that you're worried about is that necrotizing enterocolitis and these strains of bacteria that affect the gut in such a devastating way. And yeah, you're right, Hugh, like the microbiome, God, like it really is like a frontier of medicine at the minute, isn't it? And we know that all the people looking into the adult gut microbiome and gut brain axis and the effects on mental health as well as physical health, and this, that the world is moving to a place that's much more educated about nutrition and all these different things. It's really exciting to see all this sort of develop in real time. And I wonder if we'll look back at this sort of time as like, yeah, this was these were the early, the people betting on this earlier, the people that won later, you know, like what a space to pick. Like, yeah, it's incredible. But yeah, these founders are great, specializing in chemistry, biophysics, microbiology, neuroscience. Yeah, who's who of science there. If you're going to put a team together to start a biotech company, it'd probably be along those lines. But yeah, let's get them on the podcast.
I'm looking forward to feeling intimidated when we meet them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. God, fire outshines my scientific knowledge. Cool. Thank you, Hugh. Yeah, good rundown of the stories from this week. Yeah, funding, VR, David versus Goliath, and yeah, Booby Biome. Thank you for joining me, Hugh. If anybody wants to grab the stories that we talked about today, you can head to healthtechpigeon.com. There you can sign up to the newsletter and grab the links to all of that stuff. Also some jobs and podcasts you can listen to and all that kind of thing. And yeah, if anyone wants to get in touch with us, yeah, there's an email at the bottom of those newsletters. So yeah, thanks for joining me, Hugh. And we will catch you all next week.